This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Design by Subtraction.
Thief turned super cop, Eugène François Vidocq.
The Last Fantasy Film Essentials.
And Brain Radio.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And today in the gaming hut, oh, there's only one die. It just rattled by itself, and there's just one miniature. It's actually kind of a macrature. It's like a big dragon. We're all going to, you know, use theater of the mind to fight it. And, instead of a bunch of Doritos, we got that one challenge chip that you're supposed to eat. Well, at least Peter Frampton is still a double album, because this is still the Gaming Hut. And today in the Gaming Hut, we're going to bring up a topic that I alluded to in my interview with our friend Matt Orr of Wet Ink Games, when I mentioned design by subtraction. And Robin, you have got a question about design by subtraction, so go ahead and ask it.
The question is, what is it? What do you mean? Unpack that, man.
All right. Basically, design by subtraction is a way to take a mass of game design material. Often you do this if you're working with another game rules set with GURPS. It is the only way to design with GURPS, but many, many people do it with Dungeons and Dragons or with other popular rule sets that have sort of a multiplicity of cases, lots of side crannies and nooks. I kind of did it even with the Storyteller when I was redoing Vampire, but it is the old, you take your block of marble and you chip away everything that doesn't look like an elephant, and then you have a statue. In this case, you take a rule set and you chip away everything that doesn't look like your game's core activity until you have a rule set. And the notion being that many rule sets are, let us not say overridden, but they are designed for a different circumstance than you are using it to design for. So if you're trying to build a simplified dungeon skirmish engine to be at the bottom of some other thing that you're doing, many people have designed by subtracted D&D, starting with the OSR who just go back to, you know, basic, or they go back to zero D&D or whatever they do, and they start with that. So that design by subtraction has already kind of been done for you. But you can also go back to first principles and say, do we need all these character classes? Do we need all these levels? Do we need all these feats? Do we even need feats? What are the core bits of this game that we do want to use? And then you sort of can lift them out and use them for whatever you're doing. And that is, I find, can be a more comforting way than sort of sitting there with the blank page where you're like, 3d6? I don't know.
Right. Because I guess the opposite version of this would be designed by addition, where you say, okay, and both of them flow from the same thing, the thing I often talk about, a term I think I came up with called core activity, which is, what is this game about? And you typically, in my formula anyway, you distill that to, you are X, you do Y. So you are vampires engaged in undead political intrigue. You are fantasy heroes looting dungeons and fighting dragons. You are 1930s investigators probing the Cthulhu mythos. Those are all core activities. And so whether you're designing by addition, you're starting with that core activity and say, well, what's the first thing I need if that's my core activity? Or in this case, designing by subtraction, where you have a big corpus of rules possibilities. And probably if you're distilling a big popular rule set, there's a good chance that you are distilling not only the current rule set, but other past versions of it that people may have an affection for. So these are sort of mirror image versions of itself, where you continue to check whether, do I need this thing?
Right.
Do I need a version of Frenzy in Vampire? And the answer to that is, well, yes, of course you do. It's implicit in the, you are vampires and you're engaged in political intrigue. What would screw that up? We got to have that. That's a core thing. On the other hand, you know, underwater combat rules, do we need that to be vampires engaged in political intrigue? And the answer is probably not, because you didn't mention in the core activity that you're underwater vampires. Somebody might come along later and have an underwater vampire source book, but that is not your worry or concern. Other people will come along and add things to your simple structure.
Yeah, that is the way of the world. And when you are aiming at that core activity, you can also aim not just for what is this game about type mechanical rote things, but what kind of feel are we aiming for at the table, and do our rules support that, or do they get in the way of that? And for Knights Black Agents, for example, I began not designing by subtraction, but designing by at least sort of stepping back and looking at Esoterrorists, because that was the contemporary gumshoe game at the time. And then saying, I don't need these abilities in that are in Ezo for Knights Black Agents. I do need some other abilities. I don't want to do characters this way. I want to do them template style. And then saying, oh, but I also want this game to always feel like the middle fight in the middle Bourne movie. What do I put in, or what do I take away to avoid it not feeling like that? And in this case, the answer was put in stuff from the other Esoterrorist book where you'd written some combat maneuvers. And I said, those look good, and I can sort of rotate them half a turn and make them Knights Black Agents combat maneuvers. But in another case, you could very easily be doing something with, say, Spycraft, which is another terrific spy game, but is very, 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 you know, peak D20 design, and you can say, this doesn't feel like the Bourne movies, I'm taking it all out. And that would be more specific design by subtraction.
And what you've described is not a process by which you are exclusively subtracting or exclusively adding, but rather you are doing one or the other, depending on what your block of marble looks like, what your corpus of rules you have that you're working with. So when you had just Esoterrorists to work with, you did have to add things because, for example, the chase rules necessary for a big chase of cars around Paris was not present in Esoterrorists. So you couldn't subtract your way to that. You had to add your way to that.
Exactly.
On the other hand, were you working with GURPS, you would probably have to choose between 7 different sets of chase rules and possibly then modify one of those yet again to get exactly the effect that you were looking for, so that even with a gigantic set of source material, including past editions, you're still going to have to look at competing versions of things, see what is the one that suits what you're doing, and decide which one. Essentially, you're sort of shopping at a store, and you've got a shelf, and you go to the chase rule shelf. You may find it bare, as you did in the case of Vesateris, in which case, got to build it. Or you may find a multiplicity of different possible sort of modules for you to slot into your design.
Yeah, and then the other sort of, the other thing that you can approach as a store in this case is, even if you have subtracted a bunch of stuff out of, say, D&D, but you know that there has to be firearms in this game for the setting to work, there's a ton of firearms rules by now for various versions of D&D, and you can either go shopping at the store, depending on how many of those rule sets you happen to own or have access to, or you can deduce those from first principles and say, what firearms need to be in this iteration is deadly. That's the most important thing about firearms, and I have to make them deadly. And you could either find something that is genuinely deadly in regular D&D and just turn it into the firearms rules, fireball, scratch out ball, right in arms, there we go. Or you are going back more to first principles and doing, you know, more conventional design by addition, to use our clunky phrase, and say, okay, gunfire damage doesn't come off hit points, it comes off constitution. And when you're at constitution zero, you are dead. And that is too bad. And that makes gunfire super deadly. And that solves the problem. Now, that creates a bunch of other problems downhill, which you then need to look at. But for right now, you've, you know, got something. And then now that you've sort of slipped this new green piece of marble into your elephant, you can think, what other pieces of marble do I need to keep or carve away in order to make that green piece look like his eye?
And another thing that you have to decide when you're looking at things to subtract, sometimes there will be things that, yeah, sure, this would go perfectly well in this game, but what amount of focus does it take if I put it in? So, for example, do you want to put grappling rules in your occult mystery game? Well, there are lots of instances in the horror stories that you're looking at where, in fact, people grapple with one another because those stories are written during the pulp era. And you go, well, we could have these, but is this really a game about grappling? I can justify it. Some people will like it, but do I want to include two pages of grappling rules? Because the people who really like those will like them a lot, and a lot of other people won't. But more importantly, everyone will go, this is a game about grappling the occult. And maybe that's not your idea. So it could go fine. It could be added. It doesn't, you know, immediately cause any other conflicts with other bits of the game. But the question is, do I want it to take focus to any extent?
Try again next time, Ghost Grappler.
Yes. And you may compromise on that. And again, go, just like, you know, the underwater combat rules for Vampire, you may decide to go, well, we can just put those in a supplement, or one where, you know, literally it's, you know, your mask wrestlers against the occult. There's a scenario where you do some wrestling and you can throw that in there. And that gives the signal that although you can grapple in this game, you don't necessarily have to. And more to the point, grappling is not what it's all about.
Well, now that we know what it's not all about, I suppose we should find out what it is all about, which is to say, making money for the podcast by listening to and acting on this wonderful ad. Do the hours you spend not listening to this podcast leave you listless and bored?
Never fear, because for a limited time, you can get much more Ken from the Bundle of Holding.
Its new Ken Writes About Stuff bundle presents more than 36 small supplements from Pelgrane Press by me, Kenneth Height, the person you are now listening to.
Do you mean you, Kenneth Height, master Lovecraftian writer and gumshoe stalwart?
I believe you left out author of Suppressed Transmissions, Tour to Lovecraft, and the Nazi Occult.
Could these be the bite-sized treatises summoning your encyclopedic knowledge of game design, history, the occult, and all things mythos?
They could be none other. Discover hideous creatures and alien artifacts. Survive Weird West Horror.
Unearth an occult Nazi bell or the Spear of Destiny.
Join the Men in Black or Dr. John D. manage the global war against UFO aliens.
Learn to command the powerful Loa of Voodoo, the alchemical elements, the human mind, or the hierarchy of hell itself.
Each entry includes statistics or material for popular gumshoe games, such as Trail of Cthulhu, Night's Black Agents, Mutant City Blues, and Ashen Stars.
This flash sale continues only until midnight Pacific Time, Wednesday, November 26th.
Grab $75 worth of me, Kenneth Height, at the Bundle of Holdings' usual bargain pay what the collective decides to pay price.
If you already have all of this, Ken, tell your friends to seize this chance to get more Ken.
Find me, Kenneth Height, at bundleofholdings.com/presents/KenWrites.
The fingerprints in our files, the mugshots on the wall, and the long list of possible suspects on our exquisitely scrabbled notebooks in front of us tell us that we're once more looking at the crime blotter. And this time we're going to once again look at crime and punishment, this time in one person, by looking at the career of Eugène François Vidocq, who is the famous criminal turned detective, possibly turned criminal again, depending on who you ask, that is also sort of a template for various fictional detectives. So, Ken, why don't you start us with his birth in 1775?
Yeah, Eugène François Vidocq is born in Arras in northern France. He's the son of a corn merchant, but he's like the sixth son, and so one assumes he doesn't get a lot of attention and also suspects that he's not going to get the inheritance of the corn merchant business. So he takes up his time going down to the salle d'armes and getting into fencing fights and also becoming a petty thief. And for example, in 1788, he steals his parents' silver plate. He is arrested and jailed for 14 days. He finds out that his dad ratted him out, which I suppose in his autobiography, he says, well, fair cop. But I think in the moment, he says, I'll get you back.
Right, because he's like 13 at that point.
Right, exactly.
So he's probably not taking this with philosophical grace.
No. So the next year, at 14, he steals all the money out of the corn dealership cash box, and he goes to Ostend, and he's going to buy passage to America and live a new and exciting life. But he is fleeced by con men and forced to become a carnival geek, a cannibal from the Caribbean who eats raw flesh. And that's a bad job, and he runs away from that and hangs out with puppeteers and starts flirting with the main puppeteer's wife, and so he's out of that job. And he takes a whole bunch of these sort of short-term jobs, often by lying about his identity, disguising himself, imposturing. You know, I'm a nobleman. Why do you ask? And then everyone says, because you're a horrible mess and you smell bad. And then he has to run away again. So in 1791, he enlists in the army just in time for the Wars of the Revolution to break out. He fights a series of duels with superior officers that wind up getting him cashiered from his unit. So he deserts ahead of his cashierment, joins under another name, another unit. He does that like three times. By 1794, although he does fight at Valmy and some of the other battles, he's back in jail in Arras. He gets out of that, you know, told, you know, go see your mom, and he runs away and rejoins the army. He marries a woman who he then immediately finds out is cheating on him, and so he deserts her and heads to Brussels, which is a hive of scum and villainy. And in Brussels, he begins to sort of work up a slightly better line of criminality. He goes up to the big town in Paris. Looks like he bounces back out of Paris because he winds up imprisoned in Lille. And I should note at this stage that virtually the only information we have about his early life is the police record and his autobiography. And we will perhaps have got the note by now that his autobiography is not necessarily to be trusted as gospel, but this right. is what we have.
Has a first-class ghostwriter, though.
Exactly. So he is in Lille, and while he's in Lille, he hangs out with some of the cool prisoners, and he forges one of them a pardon, and the guy gets out of jail, and then they investigate and say there was no such pardon. They try him for forgery. He's found guilty, and he's sentenced to the galleys at Brest, which is basically a long death sentence. In 1797, he escapes from the galleys. He is briefly a cowboy. He drives cattle back and forth across France. Then that job gets too hot. One assumes he's stealing cattle or cattle money. Goes to Holland, where he is impressed by a Dutch privateer, becomes a privateer. He escapes from privateering. So if you are
impressed does not mean that the privateer likes the cut of his jib.
No,
it means captured and forced into labor.
Exactly. Dragged on board and made to haul ropes. But have you noticed his character sheet being built? Well, I was a cowboy and a pirate. Why do you ask?
Yeah, so he's definitely a GURPS character.
There is another insane litany of arrests and escapes over the 9 years from 1800 to 1809. This segment would last forever if we did it. But he is finally, still from this forgery and from the escape from Brest, sentenced to death in absentia. And this, I think, focuses his mind a little bit. So he goes to the head of the police
a concern.
In Paris. Also, one of his old crime buddies gets hanged and he thinks, oh, I don't like that. He goes to the police in Paris and applies to become a police informant. He says, look, I'm a horrible criminal. Obviously, criminals will trust me. And the police chief in Paris, a guy with an eye for talent named Henri, says, yeah, okay, you're going to prison to be a prison rat. And I feel like maybe that was not Vidocq's plan A, but he spends 18 months in various prisons, ratting out inmates and narking on escape attempts. He then is released after, you know, on recognizance for such good work and is sent to hang out with other criminals and either inform on their schemes or provoke them into easily stopped schemes. This sort of snowballs until he has a little bit of a rep, and he knows enough ex-cons or current cons that he knows which ones will have his back, and forms a 8-person body of spies and infiltrators, sort of on his own hook. I have too much police narking to do. I need some fellow narcs, and calls it the Brigade du Sûreté, the Brigade of Security. This is men and women are in his Sûreté Brigade. And it does such a good job that it becomes an official arm of the Paris police in 1812. And Napoleon, who is paying attention to this because he is a micromanager, says, well, they're doing such a good job in Paris, we should have one of those nationally. And so he makes the Sûreté Nationale in 1813. So from 1813 to 1827, so through at least 3 changes of government, he runs the Sûreté Nationale. And Vidocq is now a well-paid, well-respected member of the French security state. It is at this time that he, in GURPS terms, reveals his new advantage of photographic memory. So he has a memory for everyone he's ever met, every criminal he's ever seen, and starts building a card file on all of them. He emphasizes in his own Sûreté work, disguise, informal interrogation, rather than take the guy to the dungeon and put him on the rack or beat him up or whatever. Just take him out to dinner, give him some good wine, start asking him. He'll start bragging about what he's got going on because criminals are stupid. No one knows this better than Vidocq, who has lived this.
And that remains the number one interrogation technique, is you trick the criminal into thinking you're his friend and looking out for him. That's still police work 101.
And he begins the sort of basics of crime scene investigation. Rather than just show up and stomp all over the place, Vidocq says, give me the details. How was the door opened by the criminal? And from his photographic memory, he can say, ah, it has been kicked in the lower panel. That means it's my old friend Fasson. But Fasson is in prison. He can't have done it. And then one of the other Sûreté guys says, Fasson escaped 8 days ago. They say, well, there's your man. Go get him. And that, you know, notion of the MO is, again, something that Vidocq brings to criminal investigation. He also, because it's a French police organization, does political investigation. So when he is with Napoleon, he is putting down royalist uprisings. When he's with the king, he's putting down Bonapartist uprisings. For both of them, he puts down popular uprisings. And this, again, is the same sort of play that he used to do with criminal rings. You just infiltrate revolutionary or Bourbonist or Napoleonic groups. He does such a good job of political investigation that in 1817, Louis the 18th finally pardons him from that long-standing forgery conviction. So he now cannot be legally executed at any time, which must have been a load off. In 1822, he befriends Honoré de Balzac, the great writer of the Comédie Humaine, the life of the streets of Paris is Balzac's subject. No better expert on the life of the streets of Paris could he find than Vidocq. Balzac puts him in a bunch of novels and a bunch of plays and a bunch of other things, either as Vidocq or as a barely disguised character. So this builds up his legend and makes him even more politically bulletproof for a while. And however, I say a while, eventually a new king comes in who is more straight-laced than Louis XVIII. He does not believe that we should have a bunch of criminals running the police department for some reason. And he basically tells the new prefect of police in Paris to just make up stuff to get Vidocq fired. And Vidocq sees where the wind is blowing, writes a unconvincingly outraged resignation letter, and resigns in 1827. And then immediately Balzac and maybe some buddies of Balzac's who need the money get together and they help Vidocq ghostwrite his memoirs. And so those become huge sellers because he, of course, names names, as is his way. With the proceeds of all that, plus whatever he's hidden away during his years of government service, he builds a paper factory in order to produce the tamper-proof paper that he had ordered the Sûreté to use, thinking, well, I'll be a sole source government contractor. That's free money. And I'm going to use ex-con labor, so I barely have to pay them. And he had also pioneered indelible ink, but I don't think he got into ink manufacturing. But again, as a forger, he says, try not to make it so easy. That's all I ask.
That is the advantage of hiring a criminal to run your police organization.
Right. Yeah. He marries his cousin, who becomes his third wife. A second wife sort of showed up somewhere in the middle of the cowboy era. But he goes out of business rapidly because everyone in the town around says, well, you're hiring ex-cons. We shouldn't have to pay for your paper because it's basically free to you. And he says, no, it's supposed to be about my gigantic profits. And his neighbors don't like him. So in 1831, he turns in a tip on a very high-profile jewel robbery. And he says, I know that I'm not running the Sûreté anymore, but if I was, I would look at these guys. And sure enough, they arrest the guys who did it. He is reappointed head of the Sûreté. However, when the robbers go to trial, they start saying, well, no, we had a lot of inside information about the house. Must have come from someone pretty high up. I wonder who it could have been. And everyone has a guess. And so he is fired again in 1832. So he gives up on government work, opens up a private detective agency in 1833 that's called Le Bureau de Renseignement, the Office of Information, constantly feuding with the government because, of course, now he's still employing criminals. He's still doing everything he did as the Sûreté, including arrest people without any ability to arrest them.
That is a role that government usually reserves for itself.
Right. And he also, you know, engages in forgery and imposture and all the other things that when you're the cops, you can do it. But when you're a private detective, maybe you can't. Admittedly, it's like the first private detective agency ever. So I guess they're making the rules then. So at some point, the government is embarrassed by how good he is at stopping, you know, the crimes that people hire him to stop. So they just descend on him and confiscate all of his files. Just take them all so he doesn't have his documentary backstop. He's imprisoned in 1842 for false arrest and fraud being faking papers so that he can get close to a criminal. He is let out. The judge on his first case hates him. The judge on his second case loves him. Fan of the biography, etc. He, through his private detective era, is a patron of the theater. He invests in plays. He sponsors productions. He pays the salary of the striking actors at a certain theater so that they can go on and keep presenting plays. He always wants to be on stage. He's exactly the guy who says, well, you know, just if there's a part for a ratty little guy with surprisingly strong calves who smells terrible, maybe I could play him.
I've also got a closet full of disguises.
So exactly.
I could use them as costumes.
And obviously, he's probably a fairly good actor, given the amount of imposturing he did, though maybe it doesn't translate as much to the French theater. In 1847, anyway, his third wife dies, which takes apparently some of the joy out of his life. In 1848, Napoleon III comes to power. Vidocq says, I've always had good luck with Napoleons, but Napoleon III at least says, you know what, we can do without you, Vidocq. So he just sort of retires. Some of his investments go bad. His ill-gotten fortune dwindles away. But in 1854, he gets cholera, does not quite die from that. In 1857, he does die. And in a touching final note, 11 women come forward bearing his last will and testament, leaving all of his fortune to them. This, it turns out, was what he was giving women in lieu of presents when he would be romantically attached to them, was the promise that he would remember them in his will. And so all 11 fake wills are dismissed. And that is how Vidocq leaves this earth in a cloud of imposture and fraud just as he entered it.
Right. But he achieves immortality as a source of literary tropes that we use to this day. He is the model for Rodolphe de Gerolstein, who's the protagonist of Eugène Sue's influential pulp serial, Mysteries of Paris, which ran in its original serial form between 1842 and 43. So he was not only the first detective and the creator of the first detective agency, but became, through this layer of fiction, the first fictional detective. And de Gerolstein passes down tropes to fictional detectives, including Auguste Dupin and Sherlock Holmes. And so he lived the tropes. People fictionalized him. Many people did. Others, examples as well, as you mentioned, Balzac uses him in a whole bunch of different fictional guises. So we therefore have many of the baseline ideas about what a detective who solves crimes is all about, thanks to Vidocq. He appears in some films. The one I would recommend is from 1946. It's called Scandal in Paris, directed by Douglas Sirk, and not what you think of when you think of the master of the Technicolor melodrama. This is a black and white period piece with George Sanders as the elegantly drawling, sophisticated Vidocq, a lot less skeevy, but not unskeevy than the historical version. There's also a movie called Vidocq from 2001 by the mono-named director Pitoff from France. It's very ahistorical in that it's a supernatural steampunk story, and it's heavily stylized. It has some interesting moments, but it's not the one I would tell you to look at. There's also one from 2018, which I haven't seen and does not appear to be available here in North America, called The Emperor of Paris with Vincent Cassel. So maybe that is good, and maybe that is more historical, but I cannot attest to that.
Well, his rat face will be more accurate, I feel, than George Sanders' wonderful head.
Right. Of course, he dies a couple generations too early to show up in person in The Yellow King. That is, as a person, but someone modeled on him, or someone who's been revived by Carcosa, could certainly show up and confront the art students in Paris in 1895.
And if your Trail of Cthulhu or Fear Itself adventures take place in Paris, we have The Secret of the Bastille already out. There are a couple of those out there in the third-party market. Why not continue them into the Napoleonic adventures of Vidocq? Because he is definitely going to know all about your creepy cult and probably have cased its temple for all the solid gold goodies in it, and will certainly be happy to set you up with some expendable cannon fodder to break in the front door when you go in the back door.
Well, before he narcs on us, we'd better get out of here and into the next hut and or segment. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Keep this podcast unsubtracted by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Scott Jones,
Dare Barefoot,
James Tatum,
Rich Spainauer,
and Oleg.
The smell of the popcorn and the not at all whir of the projector welcome us into the steadily emptying multiplex, where fortunately we've ordered ahead, so the center row center seats of the Cinema Hut are still available. We're sitting down for the tag end of our Fantasy Film Essential series. And as often happens at the end of the film festival, the one that was really popular early in the film festival gets shown again. And in this case, we have a beloved Patreon backer, Snivgritz, who called us out for missing a legit essential. We've also been called out for missing not at all essentials, but such is the way right. of the essentialist.
And also some great films that are not, in fact, fantasy films, like right. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which yeah. I would have run to include, except it's full of mythic reference, but nothing fantastical happens in it.
Nothing fantastical happens. Anyhow, The Secret of Rowan Inish by the great John Sayles, 1994. Straight up fantasy, a beautiful movie. And yeah, Robin, why don't you tell us more?
Yeah, so it's based on a 1957 novel called Secret of the Ronmore Skerry by Rosalie K. Fry. And perhaps our Irish listeners can tell us for sure, but my sense is this has a lot less BS in it than most films about Ireland by American directors. It's set in 1946. A girl is sent to live with her grandparents in an isolated fishing village after her mother dies and her father can't look after her. And she is told by a cousin who knows such things that she has a Selkie ancestor. There's a story that there's a romance with a were-seal in the family, which is just the sort of thing that happens in Irish fishing villages, I guess. She sees a mysterious figure roaming about on the rocks, presumes that to be her brother, because she had a brother who was swept out to sea as an infant because the cradle got too close to the ocean, which I think is a rookie mistake. But the thought is that possibly he is a Selkie or has been transformed into a Selkie. It is a beautiful, magical rendering of a classic bit of mythology rendered as a literary fantasy story, and is beautiful and, as Snivgritz points out, more than worth mentioning.
And now we have some movies from the last couple of years. I have seen one of them and consider it as inessential as a movie possibly can be, but it is the best Dungeons & Dragons movie ever made, the personification of the low bar. Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, starring the beloved Chris Pine and the equally beloved Michelle Rodriguez, and they are in the Forgotten Realms, and there's an owlbear. And Robin, you actually recommend this movie and consider it essential for some reason, so defend your argument.
Yes, I like it better than you do, and definitely for this podcast, if there is a recommendable Dungeons & Dragons movie, who else is going to put it on their list? And so what I like about this film, first of all, Hugh Grant turns in another one of his recent brilliant villain performances. We talked about George Sanders in the last segment. He's more outlandish George Sanders for a time. I think it's worth seeing for him alone. The thing I really liked about it is that it turns out to not be, it's funny, but it's not making jokes at the expense of D&D or the Forgotten Realms as being inherently stupid. The humor all arises from the world. When I first saw the trailer, I thought, oh, they're doing a very clever meta thing where you're going to watch a game and they're going to be hinting about the fact that there's a game master and the stuff that's happening is the dumb things that happen in role-playing games. But no, for a light adventure comedy, they play it straight. The obstacles are inventively presented. And now it's a matter of great disappointment, I'm sure, in the executive suites at Hasbro that even a well-done Dungeons & Dragons movie did not turn out to have the brand power to get people into the cinema. But I'll absolutely stand by this as something that our listeners would want to program if they're surveying the history of fantasy films.
And the fantasy heist in the middle is actually quite good and inventive. I'll give it that. And then now we have a whole bunch of movies that you have seen and I have not. And we're going to start, I guess, with the what looks like a really fun one in the sort of kids fantasy blending into real life sub-genre, Riddle of Fire by Weston Rizzulli, who is not a director that I'm familiar with. Robin?
That's because this is his first film and you haven't seen it. So
there you go.
It's quite good. And this starts a list of basically indie films that are taking on the fantasy genre. And I think this is our hope for a resurgence of fantasy films, is that there's enough interest now again to have a place to show indie movies, because there's so many platforms are looking for movies. And in fact, in streaming, movies are beginning to take over a share from television as the thing that people watch in streaming. And so it creates the space for relatively low budgeted, cool, creative things that touch on the genres that people love to have a life. And so Riddle of Fire is literally a kids on bikes movie. They're very young kids who are mad that they don't have the money to buy a video game. And through a sequence of events, they've decided that they need a blueberry pie recipe in order to have the money to get a video game after failing to steal it. And they're complete hellions. They're really great, sort of Bad News Bears level of unruly children. And this leads them to battle a poacher gang for possession of the egg. And the poacher gang is led by a witch, played by an actress called Leo Tipton. And so there's straight up magic that she's practicing, and that creates a series of obstacles that draw them further and further into trouble. There's a final confrontation at an after hours club. And it is a really fun play on the genre that doesn't take itself seriously, but also is not rolling its eyes at the idea of fantasy. So it's a lot of fun and a great example of blending a couple of different genres, one of them which has magic in it.
All right. And these next three all showed up at the most recent Robin and Valerie International Film Festival. And I believe we talked about all of them during that segment, but let's talk about them again in light of the fantasy film tradition and what they're doing for them, beginning with The Paragon from New Zealand, directed by Michael Deignan.
So this one was made for $25,000. So this is an example of being able to use a little money to make a fantasy film. This is about this sort of arrogant idiot that in the $20 million version of this, or $50 million version, Will Ferrell would play. But here it's played by an actor named Benedict Wall. He's a doltish former tennis coach who was hit by a car that wrecked his career. He wants to find the car in order to punish the hit and run driver. So he winds up training with a mysterious mentor, played by Florence Noble, to learn psychic powers, to fight another more powerful psychic. And it's a fantasy comedy. It's got a great sort of offbeat sense of humor that reminds me of the sort of height of the early US indie movement, when there were so many verbally driven films. And it's just a lot of fun and consistently funny. And it's a great example of how you can play with the genre that brings in sorcerers and wizards with no money whatsoever.
And from the world of psychics, we turn to the equally fantastical world of cryptids. And I don't think that we have a lot of We Are the Monsters movies in our fantasy essentials. Monsters, Inc. didn't quite make the cut, nor did Shrek. But Sasquatch Sunset seems to have done so, directed by David and Nathan Zellner, and that's from 2024. And all I know about it is the ad in which Jesse Eisenberg is a Sasquatch. And for whatever reason, that did not compel me. But Robin, you say it's great.
Yes. And they're not monstrous in this at all. They are a family living in the woods. They are dealing with the difficulty of survival in nature, and you feel for them throughout. It is both funny, sometimes scatologically so, but also beautiful and moving, and sometimes distressing when they're in danger. And both Jesse Eisenberg and Riley Keough are unrecognizable under their Sasquatch prosthetics. It's a strange, beautiful, funny, weird meditation on our relationship to nature and the nature of mortality. And again, an example of someone deciding to come along and do something that there's no other film like it. You can't say, oh yeah, like this other six films. It's not a time loop film. It's we're doing Sasquatches and we're taking them amusingly, but also sort of seriously. So
it's a Sasquatch slice of life. It's like Eric Romare's lost Sasquatch movie.
Well, it wouldn't be Eric Romare, because they don't talk to each other much. It'd be more like Chantal Ackerman.
All right, fair enough. And now, speaking of traditions, in the tradition of the body swap, a classic trope from the Essential series, the newest and best example is Carnal Vessels, an Australian film by Angus Kirby, another one that you've seen. And because it's for the cable, it can be a little more grown up, I assume. Yes.
And this takes us right up to the present day. This is a 2025 film. This is about two sort of quasi-aimless 20-somethings who are maybe more than friends. Olivia, played by Arnika Larkin-Wheat, and Alex, played by Daniel Simpson. They finally hook up. And once they do, they wake up having swapped bodies. And so that, as you say, that's a classic trope. But they still, this film finds new energy for that. That's a twist we haven't quite seen before, with all of the gender confusion and dismay and possibility associated with that. As you suggested, it's an adult-directed film, not for kids, and shows that it's still possible to ring new changes on a time-honored fantasy trope. It also has like a complete soundtrack of completely made up but entirely credible 70s folk rock.
I love
it's
that.
It's made on, again, a tiny little budget, but it's about this sense of kicky energy that really makes this sort of memorable. And I think all of these films that we've just mentioned are great signposts that fantasy cinema is not dead, but possibly headed in another direction. So, Ken, what have we learned? We've looked at all of these fantasy films, and some trends emerged, or did they?
I think that part of what we've sort of seen is that fantasy films, like other films, you know, we sort of came at this from the easiest angle imaginable, the horror film essentials, and we could easily relate those back to sort of social concerns of the time. That's a very, very standard reading of horror film history. And I think that we're beginning to see a little of that in the fantasy films. It's not quite as clear as saying, well, clearly Lord of the Rings is a response to the War on Terror. That's not what it is, but it's also not what it is. But we are seeing things like the prevalence of ghost movies in and around World War II, which is a completely natural, comforting fantasy to reach for, is that all of the senseless waste of human life means something. People are going on. There is an organization in charge of stuff. All of this element of the fantastic can inform the world. And then we sort of see that coming back in little waves. And I feel like more of it is the notion, not quite so much the individual moment-to-moment type stuff in horror, but sort of the bigger waves of, oh, suddenly children are a market. Disney is here to sell us fairy tales. Oh, suddenly adolescents are a market. Now we have a sort of a different bunch of concerns. Your 80s fantasies big and such like that. And so you see sort of a longer waveform than you do in horror, which I think is kind of interesting, that fantasy would be the one that maybe responds to deeper trends rather than sort of the immediate superficial Vietnam is bad. Let's have a bunch of body horror show up.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, that there are periods where, like horror, you can go, this is the interwar and post-war periods. This is why there's all of these ghost comedies or movies about death. Or you can look at, you know, different occasional eras where you can relate the theme of the what's going on in the world to them. But more often, the theme of fantasy is getting away from the world. And so it's deliberately escaping, stepping aside from topical concerns. And the trends that we've seen are more trends of the film industry, of its different waves, of the blockbuster wave, of the impact of the death of DVD sales, of the impact now of movies being more of a thing on streaming than they were previously, and also responses to technology, that Lord of the Rings became possible when CGI reached a certain level. And as we've sort of mentioned, kind of peaked at that time. And as it's been overused, and as all of the studios turning out CGI are all overstretched and on a budget, you know, there's stuff in Lord of the Rings that's better than CGI sequences that you'll go and see in the theaters today. And so you are seeing sort of a combination of, here's how we get away from everything, which is what one of the things that film promises to do. But also in each era, it is doing it in a way that reflects the state of the industry. And so rather than continue to just sort of recapitulate what you already said, it's time for us to finally wrap up our Cinema Essentials series for fantasy. It'll be a long while, if ever, before we do another retrospective like this. So let's go and do something completely different, perhaps with psychic dogs, let's say. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
It's time once more to wander in that most ill-defined of huts, the one where in one corner there's a guy working on a chronology of history that's clearly way out of whack. You can tell that just from his hair. And then there's a weird map up on the wall. I don't know what's up with that. Oh, but finally, I'm going to peer out the window, and there, howling on the moor, is an alien big cat. In another corner, there is a couple of aliens. There's a Nordic alien, gray alien. They're having a kombucha. I'm not sure how interested, however, they are in something that I'm very interested in, Bernard Kaczynski's Brain Radio.
Bum, bum,
once you hear that name, once you hear Brain Radio, you're in.
You're in.
You want to know. So clearly, we're in for a weird tech subcategory of Elliptony. And Ken, this story begins in Petrograd in 1919.
Yeah. In Petrograd in 1919, the Russian Revolution has happened. The Bolsheviks are in charge. And so everything that was mystical is now technical. Mysticism is bad. Science is good. Everyone remember that, or someone's going to get shot. There is a psychoneurological institute that was established by the neurologist Vladimir M. Bekhterev before the revolution. It starts in 1907. He's a rival of Pavlov. They have basically the same theory, but they're fighting over who said it best. So the psychoneurological institute is also the Institute for the Study of Brain and Mental Activity, which is often shorthanded to Institute for Brain Research, not to be mistaken for the other Institute for Brain Research in Moscow, which was set up just to look at Lenin's brain and say, isn't that a great brain? That's a whole different institute. We're not there. We're in Petrograd, which will be Leningrad. And Vladimir Bekhterev has been studying the work of the former circus clown and circus animal trainer, Vladimir L. Durov. And Durov has sort of gotten out of circus clowning.
You can find a really fabulous 1915 picture of him as a circus performer with his couple of dogs. So
yep.
If you can locate that online, that will put the rest of this story in context.
Into context. He has a rivalry with his brother. And so he's like, well, I'm getting out. I'm not going on the stage. They don't appreciate me. They like my stupid brother Anatoly. I'm going to just train animals. And that's basically what he decides to do after about 1913. So he's been spending the last 6 years training animals, and he has developed a method of training dogs involving imprinting a mental picture into them. So if you want the dog to go get a book, you think of the book and you think from the dog's perspective what it would look like to run and get that book and bring it to Durov. And then you stare at the dog and lock eyes with him.
And Durov supplies us a description, Ken, exactly how you achieve this state of pure mental connection with the dog. I look into Mars's eyes. Mars, of course, is the dog. Or rather, very deep into his eyes and beyond them. I make passes at the dog, stroking him slightly on the sides of his head, above the mouth, the shoulders, barely touching his fur. The dog points his nose almost vertically, as if it were falling into a trance. My movements deprive the dog of all of his will, and he remains in such a state as if he were part of my internal ego. A communication or psychic contact has thus been established between my thoughts and Mars's subconsciousness. So, as we know, the dog no longer requires verbal instructions to go and get the book, because it's not like every instruction is a nonverbal instruction if you're a dog. Yeah. No, this is dog hypnosis, right, Ken. It's dog hypnosis.
Yeah, and you're passing your thoughts telepathically from you to the dog, and then the dog runs and gets the book, or at least he does it about half the time. Durov has done, according to a later report, 1,278 experiments on human canine telepathy between 1919 and 1921. 696 were successful, 582 were unsuccessful. And among the successes are such cases as, well, the dog ran away and did a different thing, and then he came back, and then he went and did a third thing and came back. But the third time he got the book. And that must count as a success. And it's like, well, this is now getting into cat level of training. So we have questions. But anyway, Bekhterev has experimented on humans with similar methods and achieved success, especially with flighty or nervous humans. And he says the mental effect of one individual on another is possible at a distance through some kind of living matter. Here, too, we are dealing with the phenomenon of electromagnetic energy, most likely with Hertz waves, which is to say radio waves. And this is Bekhterev publishing his research in 1919 after that presentation. So in 1919, by coincidence, in Tbilisi in Georgia, the electrical engineer Bernard B. Kaczynski, and he is 29 years old at this time, born in 1890, hears an apparition of his friend's death. His mother drops a spoon into a medicine glass and it rings out, and he hears the noise of the spoon drop, runs to his friend's bedside and is told by his mother, oh, you've just missed him. He just died. And I was just about to feed him this medicine just like this. And then he was dead and I had to drop the medicine back in the glass and the sound happens again. And Kaczynski says, somehow that sound transmitted itself to me from my friend. It's the last thing that he heard in life. I need to study the electrical mechanism of the ear. And that will learn me how that happened, how I heard this thing from miles and miles away. And he begins studying the electrical nervous system of the ear, electrical nervous system of the brain. He is studying with Popov, the Russian inventor of radio, not to be confused with Marconi, the Italian inventor of radio, or Tesla, the actual inventor of radio. But anyway, he studies with Popov and picks up a lot of basic radio theory, which he then, under a microscope, decides our nerves look very much like solenoids. And very much like condensers. And goodness, we have miniature radios in our nervous system, our various ganglia. So in 1922, Kaczynski gives a lecture on the topic of brain electricity to the Russian Congress of the Association of Naturalists in Moscow. And that turns into a research fellowship because the heads of the Naturalist Association like the cut of his jib. And he then hears about Bekhterev's study of Durov, possibly from Bekhterev. The two of them are corresponding. And then he decides to go to work with Durov on animal telepathy testing. And when he gets to Durov, his first plan is to put Durov in a Faraday cage to cut off his electromagnetic connection to things and see if he can still telepathically order dogs around. And you won't believe it, Robin. It turns out the dogs just screw around when you're in a Faraday cage, unlike when you're not in a Faraday cage.
That proves it's telepathy. That's perfect.
Yeah, it proves it.
I also like the detail one account puts it about the Durov's experiments. The experiment was successful, but later on the animals refused to obey training commands, which I think is the quality of the treats probably decreased kind of over time in 1920s Soviet Russia, and the dogs.
Yeah, it just could be that the treat ration was diminished.
Yeah, the dogs hear what you're saying, but they're no longer interested.
Right. The dogs were all about the new economic policy, and now that we've returned to pure communism, the dogs are less excited about it.
What's the 5-year plan on me getting treats?
Right. As Orwell discovers, the dogs are actually bad communists. You'd think the other way around, but nope. Anyway, one source describing Kaczynski and Durov's research said they did 10,000 tests. And statistically, according to Kaczynski, the chances of coincidence are only 16 in a million. So there you go. I don't know how you would run a second order statistical regression on this, but I'm not a communist statistician. So what do I know? Anyway, Kaczynski's theory, working from the theory of Durov, is that the eye serves as an electromagnetic projector in very, very short wave, but intense bursts. And the ear acts as an electromagnetic receiver. And the nervous system is, as he puts it, a storage site for supple apparatuses of biological radio communication. So your eye has, unbeknownst to us, a second quality The ear has a second quality. Those are connected to the biological radio that is basically built up. Your nervous system is the circuit diagram for it. And he publishes all of this stuff in a book entitled Thought Transference in 1923. His research has spread to other Soviet scientists. A guy named T.V. Gerstein is in Moscow at the Other Brain Institute, and he's experimenting with human-human transference in 1925, often over long distances. Also at the Brain Institute in 1920 to 1923, this, I believe, is the Moscow one, the Rosicrucian mystic and biologist Alexander Barchenko. He is tied to a OGPU figure named Gleb Boki. He is a cryptologist and mystic. Barchenko is purged in 1938. Another OGPU-tied researcher named Vadim Chechovsky had an actual occult circle in the Lubyanka and was trying to blend the occult with radio telepathy. And he's purged in 1929, but not before he has worked with Bekhterev on long-distance hypnotism. Bekhterev himself is allegedly murdered in 1927 after working up a psychological profile of someone he described at dinner right before disappearing as a rough-handed paranoiac. And in 1927, when you describe someone as a rough-handed paranoiac and then you don't come back from dessert, there's theories about what happened to you.
Right, because the person he was describing was Stalin.
He was Stalin, yeah. Not to give it away, yeah. It was Stalin.
Right, so calling him a rough-handed paranoiac, self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. So Kaczynski cleverly does not have any theories about Stalin, spends a few weeks in 1933 with the rocket pioneer Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who is a big believer in telepathy, believes that it has real applications for rocket design, that maybe you could do a telepathic interface for a rocket, and if you can project these waves, you'd even communicate to the Earth from your rocket, that would be better. He's very excited about it, but he has his own fish to fry. And also, as Stalin consolidates power, maybe no one should study telepathy. Maybe you should study hydroelectric power plant design, Kaczynski. And so that's what he does.
Yes, nothing that could help you read Stalin's mind, basically.
Nothing, none of that. None of that nonsense. Everyone who's doing telepathy is purged. And, you know, you'd think they'd have seen it coming, as they say. After the Khrushchev thaw in 56, Kaczynski sort of peeks his head out from the hydroelectric power plants, writes an article on telepathy in Komsomol Pravda, which is the sort of teen Pravda for the commie Boy Scouts. This is in 1959. And then he is not purged for that. So he writes his sort of scientific autobiography, Biological Radio Communication. And this in 1960 is published in Kiev. He dies in 1962. It is published and translated in America by Wright-Patterson Air Force Base at the Office of Foreign Technology. And that is how I read it. So if you want to find it, it's online because your tax dollars paid to translate this nonsense book.
Yep, nothing weird about that. So this scenario writes itself. They were developing all of these technologies. They figured out telepathy. They figured out mind-controlled rocket ship consoles. And they were either purged, unable to develop them further, or put them away in a nice safe warehouse somewhere. But all of these technologies exist, and you, the player characters, whether you're doing it in the 1960s during the thaw or in Fall of Delta Green, or rather are finding them in the modern day, whether you're doing it in This Is Normal Now, where Carcosa could be making everything work when it didn't before, or in the Esoterist, where the emanations from the outer dark are really what were powering everything all along. You can have a good old-fashioned hunt, certainly being competed to discover everything by a group that wants this technology for sinister purposes, and can all be a big old hunt for these Soviet telepathic MacGuffins.
And of course, you could also do it in the 1930s in Trail of Cthulhu, and that could either be your émigrés who have fled the Soviet Union with telepathic knowledge, and you have to deal with the fact that there's a lot of other things with telepathy, and many of them are not human, and all of them are mad that you could do telepathy. Or you could be conventional Western investigators, and the Soviet guy with brain radio topples over dead at your feet, and that sets you off on the cool adventure in which you discover that the Migo or the Yithians or whoever other telepathic alien has murked this guy, and you have to find out how they and the Soviet state are interrelating, or are they, given that Stalin is frantically murdering everyone who knows about brain radio. Maybe that's Stalin's way of stopping the Migo is, oh, you're telepathic? Bang, you're dead. Problem solved.
And we don't know what the range limit is on telepathic communication, but if the
dog... At least 35 miles in 1925. I can tell you that, Robin.
Well, there you go.
That's what science says.
35 miles. If the dogs learn telepathy, they're not going to, like, teach it to humans, because then they'll just be asked to do a bunch of stupid tricks and experiments.
Get booked.
Who are they going to teach it to? The dogs 35 miles away.
Exactly.
Well, what do those dogs do? They teach it to the next group of dogs 35 miles away. So with some possible accommodation for, you know, dogs on ships and something, you know, you can hand wave your way past this part. Eventually, a dog that is imported from, I don't know, let's say Spain or Portugal to the U.S. is telepathic, and it seeks you out at Miskatonic University because it knows everything that's going to happen. And it may be telepathic, but it can't communicate all that well with you. It can just sort of put images in your head of the horrible things that it has gained by relay from the Soviet Union, and can put those images in your head. And then you have to figure out, why am I having these weird dreams? And why are these dogs beginning to follow me? And why are they helping to provide the clues that I don't use my investigative abilities to find?
And why do I want to get book? Oh, no, that's all. I always want to get book. I'm in a Trail of Cthulhu adventure. Always want to get book.
Yeah. And why do I need to leave these bones outside the house every night? So I think there's all sorts of exciting things that we can take from Kaczynski's brain radio, and therefore can declare victory over yet another podcast. And let's close this one up, and we'll open a new one a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Delay the day when this podcast shambles into the sunset by joining such backers as...
Eric R.
Peter Adkison.
Chad Ward.
Jim Crocker.
And Darcy Castleman.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.